Whoa. Shame.
Good?
Yeah, he got up from...
I gotta say, when I got up to do that in my head, I thought I was gonna be like as quiet as a ninja on that.
So not.
It's poor execution.
Yeah. It was as quiet as a Beverly Hills ninja.
I feel like I was dragging my fucking foot like
dragging
jewel.
Your fucking leg. Welcome to the Mediocre Movie Cast, Deadwood Edition, in which we go through a series rewind of one of the greatest TV shows ever made. I am Charlatan John Kissel, and with me tonight is Broad Tosser Brian.
Oh, hey, that's me. I don't get any of these intros. I still don't understand.
Pretty straightforward. I mean, we just watch these episodes. I'm pulling quotes out from them.
That's a reach. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's Brian. Cheat Shane is also with me.
Yo.
And for the first time on the Deadwood edition of the Mediocre Movie Cast is Clip Blair.
Hello.
Actually, I gotta tell you, before we go any further, I don't recognize this one.
It's EB, recognizing Otis Russell. He's a charlatan, Richardson. A broad poster, a cheat, and a clip.
Aha, there we go.
I'm a close reader. Blair, Shane, and I are Deadwood repeat viewers, and we have our talons out. But Brian, who is watching this masterpiece for the first time, is as nimble as a forest creature. In this episode, we'll be discussing the end of season one of Deadwood. The two episodes are entitled Jules Boot is Made for Walking and Sold Under Sin.
Who's Jewel?
Jewel is the gimp. Jewel's the gimp.
Okay, all right, now I'm with you. Thanks.
All right.
And before we go further, Kissel, which one of these titles do you think is better?
I think they're both pretty crappy, if I'm going to be honest. Like, again, Deadwood, not great at titles. Two episodes are pretty distinct. Jules' Boot is Made for Walking. I'm just going to call it episode 11 from here on forward. It was more character-focused, a lot of backstory about characters that we've been spending time with while Sold Under Sin. Ties up a lot of the plot threads that have been dangling through the season. But one of the things that unifies both of the episodes is that Alma's father, Otis Russell, comes into town, is quickly recognized by the viewer as an extortionist piece of shit who is out to attach himself to Alma's booming gold claim, her bonanza gold claim, and suck as much money out of that as possible. He is beaten by Bullock and run out of town on a mule. What did you guys think of him? One of the shittier characters that we've seen so far in Deadwood, definitely.
I appreciated having, I don't know, someone to root against. But I have a note here. When the whole town knows Bullock is going to beat the hell out of him, like, the sound of that beatdown is vivid. I'm not sure the right descriptor there.
I mean, all these people that came to see it, they look away as it goes on.
They kind of look away and they kind of watch. It's like watching a musical or something where the whole town just gathers around. It's like they should be singing as he just lays into him and then just pulverizes him.
Yeah, and that's something Deadwood likes to do a lot, is that something is happening in the town and it draws characters in. And yeah, that's a good thing to witness, is Otis Russell getting the shit beat out of him, leaving his teeth on the Bella Union floor.
For such a violent act, it's so satisfying. It is so satisfying to watch that guy get this shit absolutely beat out of him.
Yeah, after daring Bullock to do it. Like, right. You're not going to do this. This is a stupid thing to do. This would be ill-advised. I can blow your whole world up. And then he, yeah, just tears into him.
I mean, how awful of a person are you that EB is like, oh, Jesus Christ, that person is awful.
Yeah, sure.
My God, Al, I've never seen a worse man.
Yeah, for EV to recognize the line that he would not go across, and then for someone else to cross that line, that's pretty exceptional. That's one of the main threads. We've also got Al resolving the issue of the murder warrant that's been hanging over his head with the magistrate. He gets Adams completely onto his side, and despite the magistrate's continued outright lies about his hold over General Crook, who's arrived in town, or his power in Yankton, or the strings that are attached to the warrant, Al convinces Adams to kill him in his office, and that's the end of that. Al's more or less set for the future after getting rid of this warrant. In my recollection before this most recent rewatch, I remember this being a little fuzzy. Paying close attention on this rewatch, this is pretty airtight. I think Shane, you're the lawyer. I believe you did your thesis on frontier law in the 1860s.
Yes. Yeah. Well, mostly it was DUIs in the frontier. A lot of horse,
sure. People
horse
getting
DUIs.
Loaded up and hoopleheads getting on horses and riding them when they shouldn't have.
Yeah,
well, did this all click for you? I mean, I feel like Silas really emphasized that the magistrate, the warrant only exists in his purview.
Yeah, I mean, there's just like, which is what kills me about everyone, like, who wants to comment on modern law and talk about how established things are. When you actually look back the history of law, like, there's no way to know who's wanted for murder in Chicago when you're two states away, let alone half the country away. Who knows whether it's legit, who knows whatever, but certain people do hold certain power.
It's conceivable that once this warrant goes away, once the actual physical warrant goes away, then it's like it never happened.
Yeah, I mean, completely, like, for them to have sent it out, they sent it there. If they don't find the guy, they don't find the guy. That's it. Yeah, that's the end of the day. I mean, he goes back to Chicago. They might still have it there, but, you know, records are so awful then. So for the physical, actual warrant itself to go away at that point in our history, yeah, that's as good as being found not guilty, probably.
Okay. And the show very much tips its hand on Claggett being a complete charlatan. To bring it back to the opening, where he's lying to the general, he's lying to Al about his influence with the general. He's pretty clearly bought off by Cy at some point off camera. Mm-hmm. So it's good. We'll get into like the more thematic stuff here shortly once you get a lot of the plot out of the way. But he's very much he's in it for himself, and as we've said repeatedly throughout this first season of episodes. People that are in it for themselves are not going to do well in this show. That's not what the show is about. And he finds himself fed to the pigs at the end of this duo of episodes in the first season. We've also, I've been mentioning the general. The cavalry comes into town at the beginning of episode 12, having destroyed the last remnant of the Sioux that did not go to the reservation back in episode 8 after signing a treaty. Everyone tries, or well, Cy specifically tries to corrupt him and the magistrate as well. But having realized that this town is siphoning away his troops, he packs up his camp and leaves to let the camp kind of find its own way. Having cleared out any potential for outside violence, he's done his job and now he's out. The camp can find its own way.
Yeah, and this whole thing with the general really drives home the fact that Al can read people and is willing to understand what someone else is thinking, and Cy is just way off. Al stops, you know, after a couple overtures.
Overtures, yeah.
There we go. And doesn't try to, you know, corrupt him at all, because he's like, I got this. This guy's not into it. And Cy just continues to get more and more blunt and try to, you know, beat him down with his bribe, basically.
Yeah, and
I think one of the one of the good things the general brings to town is it reminds the viewer that there are people with integrity still alive at this time, as he is unwavering in his job and dedication and what he has signed up for, which is probably why he has made it to general. But he is easily the most honorable person we've seen in all of the episodes.
I've got a bit of a different take on the general. My scene of the week, spoiler for the rest of the episode, is his speech to the town.
Yeah.
Juxtaposed with the soldier.
Right, the crazy.
Who is telling a very different story and a more true story based on his just being further down the line and more closer to the ground.
Right.
The general is, he's incorruptible, sure, but he's doing a corrupt job. And I think something that these two episodes and their relationships to authority, both parental and governmental, it's a lot about the corruption of that relationship and the corruption of that relationship between the U.S. and the Indians, that it's driven out man, woman, and child through crooked treaty dealings and through outright massacres, and the general being an instrument of that. It's not something that comes up in the series a lot, but it's very clearly on their mind, even without wanting to make it, without wanting to make the series about that specifically. It's always hanging in the background. It's the original sin of this area,
right?
That's something Milch talks about a lot, is original sin.
Right. I mean, I guess, again, as someone who doesn't read too deeply into things, I'm just going with what you see on screen of him being like the only person who can't be bribed and doesn't get super fired up about every little thing that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very much more than just the one thing, no question. It would have been very easy for him to just leave some soldiers there, as I asked him to.
Yeah, that was a lot of money. What was it, like $50,000 at one point?
Which I feel like is a million. Inflation adjusted. I don't know.
Right.
We've argued about this in the past.
What year is this? I'm going to look it up real quick.
1876.
Okay. Yeah, and I feel like I'm actually more with Brian on his integrity. I think he is a man of high integrity. He has a job to do and does it. And I think since we're talking about going back and forth between your duty and integrity, blah, 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 we see before this, I feel like Bullock had the most integrity in town, and we see him waver in these episodes and ask Al's people to kill Otis.
Yeah.
Even though he goes back on it eventually, we still see that wavering. I don't see the general doing that at all.
I think these episodes are all centered on ethics and what it's a person's character, but it's gray. You know, what you do in a certain situation might not be what you would do in a different circumstance. So
yeah.
I think it's interesting.
I think, speaking of ethics, I mean, might as well move into I think the biggest moral quandary of all this is the doc and the reverend. And
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Beautiful from scenes. From the outset, or like if you took away all the nuance, Al murders the reverend in this episode.
Right.
The nuance of that is it's an ultimate kindness. It's right. A supreme kindness. The Reverend is getting progressively worse over the course of these two episodes, to the point where he's with the doc full time, and the doc taking his oath to do no harm seriously, dances around what he's asking Al to do for the Reverend and Al. Tearfully, which is something I don't know that we're ever going to see from Al. I don't think we ever see from Al again, him getting this outrightly emotional. He smothers the Reverend and says, "You can go now, brother." The Reverend reminding him of his own brother. That's, again, not something that you would see Sai do, for example.
Oh, gosh.
Sai would leave him into the woods. He would dump him in the woods.
All the feels in this episode.
Yeah, a lot of feels in this episode.
even thing with that, like with the doc, not only can he not harm the Reverend, but he also can't deal with the Reverend dying slowly. I think it's just like too much for him.
Oh, his whole soliloquy
Oh man, of, yeah. Of we're going to talk a lot about the doc in our character focus this week.
Great.
I think we picked shittily last week, or I picked shittily last week with Eddie Sawyer.
No, I think Eddie Sawyer is still a good pick. I still like that pick.
And he had such a good... we talked about shuffling his feet and Gambit. That was just a great.
That is, yeah. Yeah,
that's one of our best discussions.
Some solid sidebars in our discussion of Eddie Sawyer.
Great quote from Eddie Sawyer, just since we're on it. When Bullock's beating the shit out of Otis, he just goes, "Watch the felt, gentlemen." So good.
Yeah.
But continue with it. I was going to make this scene with Al and the Reverend my scene of the week, but I might as well just throw it out there now because we're talking about most of it. But I don't think Al could even go through all the way with it being unemotional. He had to detach himself from doing that to the Reverend because there's still a part of him that was like, I can't do this, which is why he turns to Johnny and says, I'm going to turn this into a job. I'm going to turn this into a teaching moment. And so he saves himself emotionally.
And even though he fails at that, as everyone else does in the room, he's got all of his, effectively his sons in the room watching dad do this thing. And they all recognize that dad is emotionally invested in what's happening here, more than perhaps we've ever seen dad be emotionally invested. And it affects them just as much. And the idea of Johnny being a road agent after this is hateful. Thankfully, I mean, spoiler, Brian, we don't get to... Johnny doesn't become a road agent slaughtering families. That would just be way too much for his character and for the series in general.
Right.
More character stuff.
Hold on, quick timeout. The Bureau of Labor Statistics only goes back to 1913. But $50,000 in 1913 is worth $1.2 million now.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So there's your Brian Hartman econ recap for the week.
Oh, boy.
We're just going to push our glasses up our nose and continue with Trixie and Al have a brief falling out. She goes to see Saul and manufactures some nonsense. Reason for her to square in her head why she's there. She and Saul hook up in Bullock and Star Hardware, and Seth is agitated by several things in these two episodes, and he mentions this to Al, and Al essentially breaks up with her and recruits a new prostitute to be his number one gal.
Episode 11 is a breakup episode. I mean, I know it's characterization, but it's as close to a teen comedy as Deadwood's going to get.
Yeah, I feel like Saul is the valedictorian of his class who falls in love with the girl who kind of sleeps around a little bit.
Yeah, she's got a leather jacket on.
Her thong, hangs out in the back.
Sure, yeah. Perfect. Blair's teen references are much more contemporary than mine are.
John's was like, "Oh, she watches The Simpsons, even their moms."
Yeah,
I was thinking
Grease, basically.
He's got a car. Oh my god.
Last thing, Seth and Alma consummate their relationship as well. She turned on by his destruction of her father. And feeling satisfied with himself, he accepts the sheriff job, and all is right with the world, and with Bullock. And as far as this moment goes,
this is actually how I proposed to Blair. It's the exact same thing. Just
you beat her dad up.
Yeah, just beat him up pretty good at a Virginia Tech football game.
And then Blair raised a shot glass and said, "Huzzah!"
I was standing on a bucket too.
While we're talking about Bullock for this brief moment, I'm going to talk about my disdain for him still. This is a spoiler because I've only seen half of season two, but he mentions buying this piece of land on the western slope. Now, when you hear that, surely you think acreage and beautiful trees and this sloping piece of wonderful property. And we're going to see quickly in season two that it's 100 yards from where he's standing, right on the edge of town. And God, that guy, he kills me.
It's a small area.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, like, Brian, what do you expect? You've seen Deadwood. It's like mud and horseshit.
Right. So when you say the western slope, doesn't that sound like it's someplace nice, like buried in the trees, rather than just 100 yards away?
Just any little thing. Shit on bully.
Pretty much at this point,
his description of land is garbage.
Awful. Yeah, complete
Brian,
garbage.
Don't read All Quiet on the Western Front. You're going to be disappointed. It's not about trees.
It's pretty loud, too. And, of course, did anyone pick Al's blowjob monologue as their scene of the week?
I didn't. I just anticipated.
Okay,
you
so
were
we
going
can
to.
Talk about it now. I didn't either.
Is this where he's going on and on about his past?
Yes.
Okay, I have just a note to talk about that, but I didn't pick it as scene as the word.
The particulars of it is we learn that Al was abandoned by his mother at the orphanage where he now buys prostitutes from in Chicago. But the longer version of it is that Al is going on about the minister and he just needs to die already. This looking back is pointless. Look ahead. But in the next breath, he tells Dolly, his replacement for Trixie, a very long and agitated story about his origin. So he can't follow his own advice. Thankfully, because it's an incredible speech. It's a pretty fantastic scene. To hear Al go on like that.
I think this, my first time through, was one of the first times that you start to, you know, see Al as not a terrible human being.
Yeah.
I can definitely see that.
If I'm being super uncharitable, the kind of, I'm a terrible person now because my childhood was so shitty, that's a bit of a trope. It's kind of like an easy pathway into building sympathy for a person who may or may not deserve it. But I think Al and McShane playing him in general are so overpowering that I don't care. I might be agitated by that if it was like a lesser character.
There's just so much depth there.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at his relationships with other people that make him a more sympathetic character.
So yeah, any character stuff within the blowjob monologue, that's all well and good, but just the delivery of it and the writing of it is so fantastic. So fantastic. This is really high-minded and pretentious, but I mean, it's poetry. It's fucking poetry.
And you're going to recreate this poetry for us?
I can if you would really like me to.
Kissel.
I've got Kissel, it in front of me.
Kissel.
Okay. Low job monologue.
This is totally unexpected, guys. It's totally unexpected.
It's a totally organic recreation of the blowjob monologue. I'm happy to do so. So, just a few seconds, draw the veil, get into character. Now I see what the fuck's in front of me, and I have to pretend it's something else. I was fucking her, and now I'm gonna fuck you, if you don't piss me off or open your yap at the wrong fucking time. The only time you're supposed to open your yap is so I can put my fucking prick in it, otherwise you shut the fuck up. Now, hold on to that, huh? Point is, the minister's gotta fucking die. I mean, that's the fucking point. He's gonna die sooner or later. I mean, he's making a fucking jerk of himself. And I mean, well, why go on with that? Who's gonna benefit from that, huh? No, you just gotta kill it and put an end to it. You don't linger on about it. You don't fucking go around weeping about it. And you don't, you know, behave like a kid with a sore thumb. You know, well, Oko sucking it. My poor fucking thumb. I mean, you gotta behave like a grown fucking man, huh? You gotta shut the fuck up. Don't be sorry. Don't look fucking back, because believe me, no one gives a fuck. You understand? You shut the fuck up, huh? Give me that. Hey, you, suck my dick and shut the fuck up, huh? Come here. Come on. Now then, here. The place where I found you, huh, is where this warrant's from. could you believe that I may have stuck a knife in someone's guts 12 hours before you got on the wagon we headed out for fucking Laramie? And no, because I don't look fucking backwards. I do what I have to do and go on. Whoa, 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 whoa. What? You got a stagecoach to catch or something? Slow the fuck up. Now, did you know the orphanage part of the building you lived in, behind it, she ran a whorehouse, huh? Oh, so you knew. So what are you fucking looking at then, huh? God. Now I'll tell you something you don't know. Before she ran a girls' orphanage, fat Mrs. fucking Anderson ran the boys' orphanage on fucking Euclid Avenue as I would see her fat ass waddling out the boys' dormitory at 5 o'clock in the fucking morning. Every fucking morning she blew her stupid fucking cowbell and woke us all the fuck up. And my fucking mother dropped me the fuck off there with $7.60-some-odd fucking cents on her way to sucking cock in Georgia. And I didn't get to count the fucking cents before the fucking door opened, and there Mrs. Fat-Ass fucking Anderson, who sold you to me, I had to give her $7.60-odd fucking cents that my mother shoved in my fucking hand before she hammered 1, 2, 3, 4 times on the fucking door and scurried off down fucking Euclid Avenue, probably 30 fucking years before you were fucking born. Then around Cape Horn and up to San Francisco, where she probably became mayor or some other type success story, unless by some fucking chance she wound up as a ditch for fucking cum. I think we're going to call it there. I'm not going to do Al's O-face.
That was the most important part, and now I'm really disappointed in that.
Oh, well, you know, you got to call it somewhere.
That was great, Kizzle.
Thank you. That was so much fun.
Good.
Yeah.
Deadwood dialogue. I mean, we're talking about doing a Mummer's Farce equivalent of Cruel Masquerade in the Game of Thrones edition of the Mediocre Movie Cast. It's not going to work as well, because the dialogue is nowhere near as fantastic as it is in Deadwood. It's going to be a lot of this place and nouns and proper names and all that kind of shit. It'll be disappointing.
I'm looking forward to people's accents.
Oh, sure. No accents. I'm not even going to try. Don't be silly.
With that, we're going to move on to our scenes of the week. Shane, what do you got for this week?
I am going to go with... I was going to go with the doc scene from earlier, but... the Reverend making his way out of the world. But I think I'm going to go with the whole scene with Otis... just basically talking Bullock to the point of violence. And... what I love about that scene in particular is you'd think that just beating the shit out of Otis would be the apex of the scene. Like, that's where we spike it, and then it's just going to go down from there, and you can't possibly maintain that. But it's this slow build-up where he's talking and talking and talking, and you're like, just please hit this fucking guy. And he finally hits him, and it's great. And then you're like, okay, what's going to happen next? He walks out. And the scene continues. The music from the parade starts, and you're just taking in the rest of the camp that Bullock was completely oblivious of a second ago. And it keeps that peak up for me. And we hit the Chinese alley with the sheriff or the garbage sheriff. The intensity keeps going for another 2 minutes. I just don't know how you can, like, how do you think about it in your head to put that scene together to make the actual violent interaction not possibly the high mark of the scene?
Yeah. He's leaving the Bell Union, having just done significant violence, to hear a speech about the doling out of significant violence and the smaller doling out of violence with Con Stapleton and in Chinese Alley. And then he goes to Dan and requests violence on behalf of himself.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sorry. I kind of actually stepped on your scene of the week. I realized that. I guess the thing was was one fluid scene, and to see Bullock's face coming out, like, the whole thing was just great. It's one continuous scene. And I'm sure you have your different take on the parade in general. Crook's speech in a second here, but I don't even, like, just getting the General Crook speech, like, that's where it ends to me. That's where the intensity ends. That's where you're finally let down.
Okay. I mean, and during that whole sequence too, like Bullock is flexing his hand. And you can see his like bloody knuckles. And
yeah,
he messed his hand up. Like the aftermath of this act is trailing him as he takes in the rest of the camp and the world that is happening with around him. That has no bearing on like what just happened in the Bella Union, as significant as that was. And like just the filming of it, and Otis is another great speech in these two episodes. Otis just rattling off the pros and his argument, all the ways that he can destroy his daughter and Bullock by extension.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah,
it was like watching a fellow attorney get punched in the face, and I felt great about it.
Ryan or Blair, anything to add on Otis and Bullock, their big confrontation?
I had the thing to say about the sound quality was incredible, so
yeah,
that was good.
What do you got for your scene of the week, Brian?
I will steal from my favorite lines and go off in the left field here and talk about the camera arriving for Newspaper Guy.
Oh yes, it's so good.
And Newspaper Guy. Merrick is so great throughout this episode.
He's great all the time, Blair. All the time.
No, I agree. Newspaper Guy.
Can I have his? Should I say his monologue now?
Go for it. Yeah, go for it.
All right. So he says, "Oh God, Philistine!" as they're opening the thing. Joseph, what you see here is an American optical back focus swing with a Meyer Gorlitz trial plan 210mm lens, the finest photographic apparatus manufactured in this country. What William Henry Fox Talbot could have achieved in service of this fine apparatus. And then they start hammering on the box, and he's like, oh, God!
It's like he's being physically assaulted with every like jostling of this box.
And I feel like as sort of a technology nerd, this is like his moment of like unboxing and pulling the plastic off of things that we have now.
Yeah.
He's just so excited, and I can relate, and I love it.
And he's telling this like courier about William Henry Fox Talbot. Like, he assumes that everybody is on his level of knowledge. And can't imagine a world where that's not the case.
Yeah, it's me telling the UPS guy how excited I am for my 250mm birding lens for my camera. I mean, he just doesn't care one ounce.
Speaking of, Kissel, Brian and I haven't updated you on our fantasy baseball.
Oh, well.
We're 3-0. We're losing this week, but we have a good chance for tomorrow.
I'm sorry, I just had like a little stroke. I didn't
What does the general say to Merrick? He's like, he just says, oh, God.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. That was my reaction to what you just said about fantasy baseball. Oh, God.
And they don't care. I know you don't listen to our podcast. Yeah, every week Brian and I update Kissel on our fantasy baseball team.
Oh, gosh.
Blair, you were a late addition, but did you have like a specific scene in these two episodes that you call out?
Hold on, are you gonna answer for me?
No. I was just saying, if you didn't have a scene, I would like love to hear your input on one. But if you have one,
I gotta go with the doctor's prayer.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
I mean, it's a beautiful, raw, vulnerable prayer that so many people have uttered throughout history. I just think it was it captured a really human emotion and human response to God. So I love that. It was great.
Yeah. So human that it becomes intrusive. Like this is way too personal for us to watch. Like there's a moment when Doc's like really getting into it.
Yeah.
Where his head goes behind like a desk or a drawer or a table or something. Because it would be cruel to like really get up into his face and see this.
Well, he's clearly repeating things that he's heard other people utter as they're losing their life. Like, those are the most intense moments, you know. Of life, and so that's really, really intimate.
And you get the feeling that this is the first time he's done anything like this since the Civil War, so this has been building up for like 12, 13 years, and it's all just spilling out of him in this really messy, messy rant. Yeah, that's a tough scene to watch.
Yeah.
Mine.
It's beautifully done. Yeah, all the feels.
And beautifully shot, you're right.
Yeah.
Brad Dourif was the only one of the male cast to get an Emmy nomination for the first season, and I think that's justified. Well, no. It's not justified by any means, because they could have gone several deep, but it's justified that Doc was rewarded with that nomination, because yeah, he's consistent, and we're going to talk more about him later, but he is consistently excellent in the show.
Later, isn't this where we talk about him right now?
I've still got to do my scene of the week, Brian.
Oh.
Just because I did a five.
Kissel, what's your scene of the week?
That's a great question, Blair. Mine was the General's parade and speech, as we alluded to earlier. The masterstroke in this sequence is having the private next to Bullock talk about what actually happened in this campaign. Like, the General is
pulling out his hair.
Yes, obviously deeply disturbed by what he did. While the General is on his horse, addressing the town, talking about what a great trial this was and how it made them better as a unit, while the private is talking about having to eat his beloved horse and taking his anger out on the women and children of this village of Indians that was wiped out to a person. But hey, at least we got these gloves back and this flag. This whole thing was just to out of revenge for Custer, and the big victory is that Crook waves these gloves and this flag while the private is talking about all the children he killed. So big victory, and then Crook ends it with talking about the progress of the camp, and the progress of the camp meant or required the massacring of this village. So it's just like the story of America in general. If you take the most cynical view, it's built on bodies and free labor and forced labor, and on top of it is guys like Stapleton, who is utterly corrupt, or Claggett, who was utterly corrupt. Milch, he talks a lot, and I watched the extras for this season. One of the things he talks about is some of his inspiration. There's a Hawthorne story called Ethan Brand, which is about this guy who goes in search of the unpardonable sin, and the unpardonable sin is defined as violating the sanctity of the human heart. And he doesn't, and like in the story, doesn't really get into what exactly that is. Like, there's no example of that, but with that Crook speech, you see something like that. And it's also referenced in these other two episodes as well. Like, Doc his good intentions, the best part of him being a doctor and wanting to go help people in war, it was spent sawing off limbs and watching people die screaming. And you've got Joni. The best part of her was her love for her mother and her sisters, and her father turned that against her to where she was recreating the worst part of her life every day by the time she sold to Cy Tolliver. And you see that this town, for as much as we love it, as much as we love Al, and some of us love Seth and the newspaper guy and so on and so forth, it is still built on this foundation of ugliness. And it's really important and valuable that Milch doesn't forget that. That this series is built on, or that this town is built on, broken treaties and dead Indians.
Yeah, and that's actually, like, my brother Joe is in D.C. right now, and sending pictures of all the monuments and whatnot, and I love it, and I love D.C., and I love all the monuments, but at the same time, I know he also teaches a portion of class, like, hey, some of these guys are jerks, like, you know, Thomas Jefferson had slaves, you know.
He was a straight-up rapist. There's no other way to say it either.
Right. So, isn't just like, which I think is so brilliant with this series, is it isn't just Deadwood. This is everywhere. Yeah.
Deadwood is a microcosm of America.
I would say pretty much every civilization ever created,
sure,
really.
Yeah. I mean, the two greatest, the two like broader, most profound little phrases that come out of Deadwood for me is a lie agreed upon, which is the title of the next two episodes at the start of season two, and the last line of the series wants me to tell him something pretty. EB, Mare on the bucket, he wants to be told something pretty. Merrick wants to be told something pretty. He wants to believe in the best part of America while ignoring all the rest of it. But the reality is the soldier, is Joni, is Doc. These people that have been utterly broken in some ways by the actions of people that should have their better interests at heart. And people like Alma, too, has been totally taken advantage of by her father throughout her entire life. She hasn't made a single decision for herself up to this point. It's all been her father, and now she's breaking away from him.
Yeah, it goes back to, like, you know, sometimes you think, like, what is progress? What is getting better? It's just every generation, no generation is better than the one before it or after it. We all have this whole, we all have a big gray area, is what we mentioned earlier,
yeah.
and that's it.
Yeah.
Every community has a gray area of things they've done, things they shouldn't do.
Yeah. And it's something that is easily banished from your mind in Deadwood, especially like with the person of Al in particular. As charming as he is and as brilliantly as that character is played and written, Al is a sex slaver. Mm-hmm. No two ways about it. And it's really... like Deadwood wants... I really think Deadwood wants the viewer to always keep that in mind. That there is no such thing as a pure hero, as a white hat. And there is a certain thing as a black hat, but there is no such thing as a white hat.
They do a brilliant job of that, I think. Yeah. No character is morally has the correct moral compass.
Yeah, it's the self knowledge of knowing whether or not, or it's like the self deception. I mean, like the worst thing you can do is to not acknowledge how blinkered you are.
Yeah.
And
yeah, what does General say again to Bullock?
Everyone we all have bloody thoughts.
Have bloody thoughts.
Yeah, we all have bloody thoughts.
But that, yeah, that's my long rant about that parade and speech. The thing that bugs me the most, sidebar, about like, about,
is this a sidebar of a sidebar?
No, we haven't. This is sidebar A still.
Okay.
But just like the idea of American exceptionalism, it makes my toes curl. I hate hearing about it. I don't understand how you can live. I don't understand how you can reconcile that idea in your head.
MediocreMovie.club just lost 40% of the United States.
Well,
they're out.
The unspoken premise there is that we ever had them. So,
yeah. We can't lose 40% of Sean Riley. He's just one man.
Yeah. We lost
his
legs.
His
but
boss
everything
is out.
Waist up. We still got that portion of him.
I mean, we can go on this tangent. Like, I'm on the influence that America is a great nation and we are doing a lot of great things, even though we've done terrible things in the past. And
the exceptional mindset is that those bad things, was a different time.
Right.
It's easily ignored. And I take the stance of Deadwood. That's a terrible thing to be blinkered about your own history and your own past. It's a better thing to confront the world as it is, not how you'd like it to be.
That's deep.
Thank you. That's actually a corporate bromide that is passed around Baxter.
Deal with reality and reality's terms.
Even better.
That's Dr. Drew.
You all know that I was an econ major, right? And we can head back to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and sum most of this up. Stats and data.
Fantastic.
Interesting.
You've lost me.
Well, hopefully we'll get you back with our character focus this week of Doc Cochran. Blair, we've already been talking about him throughout the episode, specifically his centerpiece scene, praying in his office, like wailing in his office to God. But we've been seeing him throughout the whole series up to this point as someone who is not there for economic reasons, like most of the people in the camp. He's there ostensibly to help the people in the camp. But we also got word in the last pair of episodes that he's also there because he was busted for grave robbing multiple times, as this is something that was required by the progress of science. You need bodies to do your research, and if the culture decides that bodies are sacred because of the resurrection and so on and so forth, then you're not allowed to slice them up and figure out what's going on. And like, we were introduced to Doc.
Wait, hold on. Were we supposed to be upset with Doc for grave robbing?
I'm certainly not.
Oh, okay.
But I think like the culture in this time would very much judge him. And we were introduced to Doc. He's got like this ghoulish look on his face while he's sticking that probe through the hoople head that Trixie killed in the pilot.
Oh, that's right.
And as time has gone on, we've got to know him a lot. Like in the next episode, even, we got to know him a lot better as someone who's deeply concerned about the well-being of the powerless and the defenseless. And I think by the end of the season, we're just completely on his side. He's like he's easily one of the best people in the camp.
He's one of the, I think he's one of the deepest characters. Like, he's got so much going on, both in terms of, like, you can be mad at him at sometimes, but you love him most of the time. I feel like he's just a roller coaster of emotions compared to most people. Especially compared to awfulness of Bullock and his just...
Doc is the one character everyone in the camp needs and needs to be talk to and converse with and see at all times.
Yeah. And that gives him the power to tell people how it is.
Yeah.
Right. He stands up to Al at one point.
A lot, actually.
Well, in this, I don't know, it was 11 or 12, but he reads Al the riot act.
Yeah,
he says,
"Fuck you, Al."
Yeah, and Al says, "All right, dude, I'll take him in. I'll take the Reverend in."
Yeah,
right.
And all Doc says to him is just "fuck you, Al." Like, he doesn't get into why this is necessary to do, why this is a good thing to do. It's essentially like I wrote in my notes, just do this sacrament, goddammit. And like, it's a holy thing that Doc is asking Al to do. As ugly as it is, with no nuance, like we were saying, and it's so holy and right that Doc doesn't feel the need to say it out loud. Like, it should just be self-evident, and that yelling at Al is "get on my page, goddammit," and he does, to Al's credit.
Right. I'm gonna bring up one of my favorite lines of the week, even though it's not a line. Is that Doc goes, I don't know, he's got two or three sentences just ranting about the Calvary, and Doc is in the background, and Al is in the foreground of the scene laughing at, like, Doc just going crazy. I just love that. That's just a perfect picture of both of those characters.
Going back to the rant that Al, or that Doc gets, like, he's been saying in the last two episodes, like, he's hesitant to help Jewel. He is certainly, he's right to be, but he is very pessimistic about the Reverend. Like, the line he uses to Al to describe the Reverend's progress is that he's past Doc's art, if he had any. I mean, that could read as just general humility, the sign of, a good person. A good person's humble. But it's not that at all. It's he's seen so many people die because of the shittiness of 19th century medicine. I feel like there's just no part of his brain at this point that can classify him as a good doctor, because a good doctor doesn't bury all their patients. And this the series giving Doc the out of Jewel and some success there. So generous. Yeah. So generous towards the character and towards the viewer that you can end this first season where a lot of bad shit has happened with something just as simple as Doc dancing with his patient. That's a beautiful, beautiful scene. And I feel like that might be the first time I ever cried at a TV show. I have a pretty clear memory of watching it in the Fiji house. And wanting to get up close.
That scene, and of all of the scenes in this episode, there are like three other scenes that I cried in this episode.
I tend to be more affected by goodness and joy than like outright grief and sadness. And that's what tends to hit me harder. And I mean, in this rewatch, I mean, I've seen this episode, you know, so many times by now, but I mean, it still gets me, that ending scene and everything that comes before it as well, like stuck with Al and the Reverend and Doc in his office and Joni still too. Like we were talking shit about Joni in episodes previous, but goddamn, she just knocks me on my ass.
Yeah, and I will say, like, this in my notes was that final scene we talk about. Milch doesn't do very well with endings. It does much better with beginning things. Mm-hmm. I still don't know how you get a much better, more realistic ending than that right there. You have Al and Jewel Doc and Jewel dancing over Al's shoulder, and that's just a one night in the gem. That's it.
Yeah.
And it was this great scene.
And Trixie and Al looking at each other also.
Yeah. Yeah.
After their episode of standoffishness.
Yeah, I even I haven't sent it yet, but I grabbed a screenshot of it to post as the, I don't know, the example of what this podcast was is probably the best visual scene of what's going on.
Them dancing.
Yes, it was beautiful.
We love the Doc, but he's easy to love.
Yeah.
Favorite lines. We've been teasing. Man. Yeah, these episodes are packed with them. I've got like 8 just for myself.
I gotta open my note again.
While that's doing, I'll just kick it off with the first one. Al telling Trixie to Sally fucking Forth.
Is Sally Forth a person in history?
No.
To Sally is to go out into the world.
Oh, okay.
That's a verb.
I'll stick with Al to Trixie. You sleep tonight amongst your own. Yeah, that's right. That's that episode, right? Episode 11?
Yes.
You sleep tonight amongst your own. That was brutal.
Without looking at her. Mm. While he's collecting the $5.
And from then on out, he calls her.
He doesn't talk to her. He doesn't speak your name.
Well, no, yeah, he won't speak your name. That one. And everyone's always like, Trixie? Or Doc says, Trixie's fine. Like,
my favorite. My favorite part of that, of their whole period of disliking each other is Johnny essentially being concerned that mom and dad are fighting. He's whispering to his big brother Dan, "I didn't think Al could sleep without Trixie." It's really cute. It's really cute. Brian, do you want to knock one of yours off?
We haven't mentioned him yet. Names are killing me again. The really ugly guy.
Richardson?
The really ugly guy. Just got the shipping business.
Oh, Trelia. Yeah.
Better. Oh, yeah. He says something like, he knocked off my chewing angle.
And we know that Charlie has, he doesn't like seeing blood. So he tries to make an excuse like, I don't want the girl to see.
He's a mess.
My next one is just a random soldier who's yelling out in the gym. I won't do a 2-on-1. Take turns like white men. Whatever that means.
Yeah, he's like that. All right. I got Cold Enough World without getting going against your own.
The syntax on that is so fucked up, but God, it sounds great.
It really does.
Who says that?
Bullock.
Cold Enough World without getting out on your own.
Going against your own.
Gone against by your own or something to that effect. Yeah, he's talking to Saul about Otis fucking over his daughter.
Okay, Alma. Very good, yeah.
And speaking of Alma, I've got one from her. We haven't really talked too much about Alma. We'll have to readjust in the second season, but she's looking out the window with Sophia, watching Seth and Otis talk about her, and she says, "If we didn't hate them too much to be curious about the world, we'd wonder what they had to say." And it really hits on what I took as the theme of these two episodes, is just people being trampled upon by people that should have their best interests at heart. And like the preview of the prior line to that one is, it's talking about how she used to go into the kitchen with all the women and clean up while the men would go into the smoking room and decide what was going to happen to these women, as if they couldn't decide on their own, and B, shouldn't have any input into whatever those decisions might be.
Right. I don't have that written down, but I think that might be one of the more memorable scenes, is her just like brutal honesty to Sophia about what goes on in that time, and just like vividly describing it so everyone truly understands, so that, you know, she's turning, you know, Sophia into a feminist, which is fantastic at a young age.
If she can understand her.
That's true.
Right, right. Hi.
Brian, you got another one?
Yeah, I gotta get one from EB. I don't even remember what happened right before this, but Bullock walks in and does something, and he walks. Or no, Bullock does. I don't. Bullock walks out, and he yells out as Bullock is walking away, "Good sportsmanship, Bullock."
That's a great.
And he
line.
Holds up the Bible, also, like he's like Bullock's gonna throw something at him or shoot him.
Oh,
or something.
Man,
that's after Bullock comes into the gym after Saul kicks him out because he's with Trixie, and he witnesses Con Stapleton swearing in. He's just generally agitated by that. Anything with EB. And we got our biggest look at EB's secret weapon in Richardson.
Yes.
The stealth best character in the show.
He's so good. I know what's in the till.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have him down for any lines, but as far as just favorite reaction shots, after Otis really slaps down EB for hitting above his weight, trying to sidle up to people that are richer and better than he is, EB just looks over at Richardson, and Richardson just gives him this big shit-eating, like, struck up.
He has no
smile.
Idea what was just said.
Oh,
you know,
no idea.
I'm glad you said that, because in my notes I just wrote Richardson smile, and I couldn't remember. I'm like, what
was
that?
Yeah, I think I wrote, like, goddamn national treasure or something. Yeah. Like, fucking priceless. That's what I wrote down.
So good.
Shane?
At the end of the blowjob monologue, just to finish this episode. Anyways.
Cut to black. Yeah, that's a good
cut. Yeah, still like, it's a great speech, and you just finish it anyway. So go away.
Yeah, let the viewer catch their breath a little bit. Brian, it looks like you're out.
Yep.
I got Al yelling at Woo, trying to recreate the bathhouse scene with Con Stapleton, who just murdered one of Woo's people, and Al's yelling at Woo as he's storming out, "Did you come to camp for justice or to make your fucking way?" Like, you just have to give some certain stuff up if you're going to be out there. And it's surprising that Woo hasn't realized that, but I feel like Al maybe spoiled him a little bit with turning in Jimmy Irons. And just making it very clear that this is not why we're here.
Right.
And the episode goes on. We don't come back to that. I think, like, in reference to Milch being better at beginnings and endings, he does leave a lot of those type of threads dangling, which is totally fine with me.
That's just that's just realistic. Nothing ever
absolutely,
is convenient.
Yeah, the same thing could have been said about The Sopranos. Like, Cy moving in on the Chinese real estate with Leon, like, trying to stir shit up. Like, we're just not going to hear about that ever again. It was just a one-episode thing, and it's gone.
Right.
Shane, you got another one? Or Blair, feel free to jump in.
Since I was a late addition, I didn't write anything down, but I'll say that I really appreciate the awkward exchanges after, like, Alma or Trixie show up to the shop and, like, Star and Bullock, or just, like, try to have each other's backs, and are like, yeah, I'll go, gonna do that thing, or, oh, I needed this tool right yeah. here that yeah. I'm gonna get right now, and now I have it, and now I'm gonna leave. I just think that's great.
They'd be good college roommates.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he grabs, like, a clamp or something.
Yeah, like that's exactly. What he was looking and then he for. Walks, yeah, and when he delivers his line to Al, where he says, like, he's fucking that whore, he's got that in his hand. It just makes it.
I was thinking about that, like, if he actually carried that with him. Into
he did.
The gym. I didn't even know
he
notice
had
that.
It.
That's
he
good
had
observation.
It with him.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's
he
great.
Had it with him, which just makes it really hilarious.
And yeah, and Saul's like, "Oh yes, oh yes."
yeah,
like
yeah.
he knows exactly. yeah. He knows exactly what they're talking about.
Right. those are the only two words he says that entire scene. Is oh yes, oh yes, which he could have been saying the entire time, right?
I gotta throw out one of Al's better lines in the course of the series when he tells Doc that announcing your plans is a good way to hear God laugh.
That's yeah. such a great line.
That's a sentiment you hear a lot of.
Of course.
But
yeah.
Right. Just you can count on Deadwood to always phrase it in exactly the right way.
I thought that was good, especially after because it's after the scene of the prayer, right?
Yes, yeah.
Which is also a very common, I think, experience that people have at some point in their lives, and yet it's never depicted like that. So,
the
prayer.
The interpretation of an answered prayer.
Yeah, there you go.
Gotcha. Shane, you got any more?
Oh my god, I have like six more. One's not even a quote. It's just when the general shows up town, Johnny Burns just salutes him. And the disgust on the general's face kills me. Like, what is he doing?
My last one is just the final exchange between, not final, I don't think it's final, between Seth and Al, where Seth is bowing to his nature. And he's, I'll be the fucking sheriff. And Al's, huzzah. End of scene.
It.
I love
yep,
that. I love whenever
great.
They say huzzah, I love huzzah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm out, Shane. Just rattle them off.
All right. And then newspaper man for Brian. All right,
yes.
General, your most victorious smile. All right, stern and resolute.
he's so socially aware of what's going on.
Al, with a human being in his last extremity, is a bag of shit.
Let's just
our
wait
dogs,
a little bit on that.
Our dogs are really excited about those lines.
Hang on. Let's check that out.
Kellen, I'm going to beat your ass.
I thought that was Kellen.
Callum. All right, I'm going to do that one again. All right.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. A human being in his last extremity is a bag of shit. Thanks, Al.
Yeah, that back and forth between Al and Doc, fantastic.
Absolutely. And then, what kind of man have I become, Saul? I don't know. The day ain't over. We got a lot of good John Hawks these two episodes.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier, we all have bloody thoughts. And then to go
Oh,
with,
we'll say it a little later.
Oh, good. Oh, good. And then, you have the tin? I do. Produce it. Oh, I love that.
Something I haven't brought up yet, but in that last episode, Timothy Oliphant and Ian McShane are doing commentary. And it is so funny. Like, they just don't really pay attention to what's on screen. They just kind of go back and forth and bullshit to each other. And, Oliphant's, like, natural humor does not come out in the show at all. Except maybe in that scene, like, that you were just talking about, Shane. Like, they're banter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
it comes great. Out a little there.
On the tit. I know where it goes.
Yeah, that's great.
Those are all my lines.
Okay, that'll bring us to everyone's favorite segment, Cruel Masquerade. We devised a four-person scene, thanks to Blair's inclusion. There's no problem there. And this week, we're going to be recreating the scene in the Bella Union between the General Crook, Cy, Magistrate Claggett, and Seth, who comes in a little later. So I'll be playing Seth, Brian will be Claggett, Shane is Cy, and Blair's baritone is going to be General Crook.
I'm the General?
You're the General.
All right, well, I hope that I can read.
Shane will be starting us off as Cy, so whenever you're ready.
Full respect to Magistrate Claggett, General. Eager as we are to get taken into the territory, those wheels grind slow. While every day in this camp and Inverness, tens of thousands of dollars in gold get cleaned up, put into circulation. It's an environment to test the moral metal if we was all members of the same religious organization, which we ain't. Are we sure we can't tempt you?
I'm sure.
A small fraction of your detachment left behind, a dozen or 18 men, say, would keep the criminal element in check. Cash compensation, unrecorded.
To defend against threats from without, I suggest the camp create a militia for civil disorders and property disagreements. Have you hired a sheriff?
Yeah, we got one.
Didn't you say to me earlier, Mr. Tolliver, that you imagined that the chief use of military presence was to buttress the sheriff's authority?
Such indirection for such a tawdry purpose.
50,000 gold. I want those soldiers, General. That direct enough?
May I speak?
Mr. Bullock.
I was a marshal in Montana. My father served in the British Royal Army. My brother Robert was a cavalryman, killed fighting the Comancheros in Texas.
Why are you here, Mr. Bullock?
A man named Otis Russell is laid up in this establishment. He needs protection.
Protection from whom?
Several in this camp. I beat him badly. Others have reason to wish him dead, and the camp sheriff can be bought for a half can of bacon grease.
Well, while we're here, I will hold Mr. Russell under protection as a gesture to your brother's sacrifice.
Thank you, sir.
I would add, in a camp where a sheriff can be bought for bacon grease, a man, a former marshal, who understands the danger of his own temperament, he might consider serving his fellows.
I'm through. Thank you.
We all have bloody thoughts.
Another rendition of Cruel Masquerade. Just knocked right the hell out.
God. I think I gotta crushed say it there. I feel so inadequate doing Powers Booth's lines. He's got that gruff voice. Yeah. It's just impossible to recreate what he can do.
I think we mentioned that he was originally cast as Al, but had to back out for one reason or another, and he totally could have done it, I think.
I don't think he was cast as Al. I thought he tried out as Al. I don't know if he was ever cast. Was he?
He was Milch's first choice.
Okay.
That's interesting.
And then took like a shadow version of Al. Brian, you mentioned that you were practicing the General. Can we get a little taste?
Let me find one of his lines here real quick. Yep. To defend against threats from without, I suggest the camp create a militia.
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
that's
you did good. The work.
I did.
I practiced repeatedly, and Chelsea asked me what I was doing.
I'm so sorry, you should have been the General. I didn't even try to change my voice.
My suggestion was you go smoke a cigarette before going with the General's voice.
I feel like to do Cy, you have to rush through some lines and then slow down a little bit occasionally, but I still can't get like how he does it.
Well, we'll have plenty of opportunities to put Cy into our Cruel Masquerade as we continue through the second season of Deadwood. Shane, is this your favorite season of television ever?
Second season of Deadwood is my favorite television season of all time.
All right, so we're going to continue with this, and it's just going to keep getting better, as great, capital G great, as the first season is. the second season is even better. And we'll be back next week with a discussion of season or episodes 1 and 2 of season 2, entitled "The Lie," both entitled "The Lie Agreed Upon." Check us out at mediocremovie.club, where we're also discussing The Princess Bride. A little overrated in my estimation, and Brian's as well. And
yes, you guys are crazy.
Oh well, it's fine. It's fine.
It's cute.
Yeah, it's yeah.
It's cute.
Yeah, it's totally acceptable. We'll also be recording a podcast episode discussing Game of Thrones episode 2. That'll be airing on Sunday. We'll likely record that Sunday or Monday. It's still pretty up in the air. Oh, and we also may have Sean Riley joining us for season 2 of Deadwood. He's learned his lesson about chewing on stuff, I think, while recording. But we'll find out. Thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
See ya.